What is up, everyone? Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Gamecast. I am one of your hosts, Kenny, and with me is Tess.
Hello, everybody.
And today we have a special guest with us, Scott Derrickson, the acclaimed director for multiple films. If you've seen, you know, Doctor Strange, Sinister, or the latest film, The Black Phone, he's done all that great stuff. And he's with us today to kind of, you know, have a chat. How are you doing today, Scott?
I'm good. How are you doing?
We're doing swell. Well, I'm doing swell. How are you doing, Tess? I didn't check with you first. My fat. My ball. How are you doing?
Don't be answering for her now.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You don't know what I had to do to be here today, Kenny. No. Oh, we're all right today.
Maybe she's terrible. Right. Give her a chance.
Well, Scott, yes. If you only knew the half of it. I've been terrible for about a year now, but.
But you got a new laptop today, though, right?
I got a new laptop, so I'm much better. I'm feeling so much more. Whole now. See? That I have.
There you go. I knew something good happened.
And I don't have a migraine right now.
Solid. That is awesome.
You know, I get migraines. I'm very, very sympathetic.
Oh, my brother. Yeah.
It's a whole miserable club we're a part of.
We are part of a miserable club. Oh man, it's not fair.
It's rough. It's definitely rough. Well, with that, you know, because I typically record on a Thursday, mm-hmm. breaking the fourth wall a little bit. We're recording on a Monday, so I usually ask how the week went. If you saw any, you know, anything cool. If you read anything cool, and so I didn't do anything this week, but. This weekend, I did see Barbarian, horror film by, I think it's Zach Cregger, I believe this.
No spoilers, man. I'm going to go into that movie knowing nothing.
Oh, no spoilers. I won't say anything other than I enjoyed it, and I think people should go check it out. And it does a, it's not what you would think. I'll just say that it's definitely interesting. So definitely go check that out. But I did get to see that and a bunch of other things. You know, a week or two ago there was the National Cinema Day, where like every film was like $3, no matter what. Like if you're an IMAX or whatever. So yeah, I was in the theater for a long time, a long time. What about you, Tess? Did you watch anything last week or read anything cool?
I've been watching. Sorry, I've been watching House of the Dragon and what is that other show that I can't stand? The Rings of Power. And I've been doing this to myself, and we talked about it. We have already talked about how I wasn't going to do this to myself, and I'm disappointing myself, and that's just because I'm such a nerd. I'm upset because I'm a nerd and I keep asking all these questions of like these whys, and I'm like, why is this happening? And you know, I read all the books and stuff. And so I'm just, I have feelings. So yeah, that's where I am. I just have feelings.
What about you, Scott?
I'm caught up on House of the Dragon also. This week I finished the limited series. I believe it's on HBO Max, the Resort, which I very much enjoyed. It's really good. It stars Kristen Milioti, who I knew from the movie Palm Springs. Boy, is she an extraordinary actress. She is really something. Very, nice. Very good actress. I don't know many of the other actors' names that are in it. Nick Offerman is in it, but he's always great. I love him in Devs. It's a really, really fantastically entertaining show. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, see, I'm gonna have to put a pin in that because I have a ton of shows I need to catch up on. So I'm definitely gonna check that one out.
I'll try to watch that.
Yeah, no one seems to be talking. No one seems to be talking about it, but it's very good. And I found the conclusion of it, the final episode, extremely satisfying. It's a great show.
Awesome.
All right.
I'll have to check that out. I'm gonna have to check that out. I refuse to watch House of the Dragon.
We know
because of Game of Thrones, but I do want to watch Rings of Power. I think it might be cool. And you know, despite all the discord that's going on right now, I think it might be cool. But beyond that, we want to, you know, because that's basically our week a little bit here. Beyond that, though, we did want to talk with you, Scott, about a couple of things. But the first thing, I guess, is how are you feeling with you know, as of right now, with the Black Phone being not only, you know, critically acclaimed, but like a box office smash right now, it seems. That's got to be like a cool feeling, especially with it not being tied to like, you know, any huge series or anything like that, like, you know, which usually taken over the box office. You know, how are you feeling?
I lost you for a second there because I was, you started talking about, this is what happened. You started talking about Rings of Power and I was closing the other web browsers on my computer, and I closed the web browser for this Zoom meeting that we're having. And oh. So I was like, oh dear. So I rebooted it and I came back and you were still talking. And I thought, oh my God, they're never gonna know. But then you asked me a question and I have no idea what it was.
Got you. Okay.
I have no idea the context. So,
you can come back anytime.
Yes. Was the question about the new show?
No, it was actually about your film. This is hilarious, okay. By the way, because the same thing kind of happened when we had David F. Sandberg on here, where the program just kept closing on him when he tried to talk, or like, no, he would be muted, and so he would have to close the program down and then come back. So
well,
this was
just me closing it for no real reason, but I'm back and I won't touch my computer again, so hopefully we'll be fine.
No worries. My question was dealing with the Black Phone being a critically acclaimed and, you know, a box office hit. I was saying how are you feeling with that, knowing that it's not, you know, tied to like a big franchise or anything like that, but it's still doing really well, you know, in theater.
Oh man, it's very satisfying, especially to come out in the summer and, you know, be competing with all these, you know, huge movies and to do so well. And you know, the people have had real emotional responses to the movie, you know, and I think, for me as a filmmaker, there's a lot of things that you can enjoy about a movie being released. And oftentimes there's things that are terrible if it's not reviewed well or whatever, but the most satisfying thing by far is when you just have the sense of, oh gosh, I put something out in the world and the vast majority of people who, you know, paid their hard-earned money and got a babysitter and bought popcorn that cost $50, you know, or at least it feels like it cost $50. They got also that they could watch a movie on a Friday or a Saturday night, you know, and to know that the majority of people who did that got their money's worth. That's the most satisfying thing for me as a filmmaker. You know, that's the thing I think about when I'm making a movie, is that I'm making it for those people. You know, I'm making it for everybody who pays their hard-earned money to go watch a movie in a theater. It's great. Right. And so for that to happen and for it to be so well received, it's great. It's wonderful. It's a great feeling.
That's awesome. So definitely. How did you actually get into filmmaking, and even more specifically making horror films? Was writing and directing always a goal for you?
I thought about it, you know, as far back as I can remember. I mean, my dad had a Super 8 camera in our home when I was a kid. I used to play with that. And when I was in middle school and high school, I started spending some of my own money, like allowance money, and I had a paper route. And I started spending some of my own money to buy, you know, film cartridges and shoot little movies and you know, that sort of thing, and played with the home video camcorder as well, but I was always more interested in the Super 8 camera. And you know, and then I, you know, when I went to college as an undergrad, I was definitely planning on going into film even at that time. In fact, the moment that I really think I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker was when I saw, believe it or not, it was when I saw Top Gun. And I made a movie. I made a movie with Jerry Bruckheimer. I told him the story. I saw Top Gun at the Century 21 Theater in Denver, which I believe is long gone now. But it was still in my memory, maybe the best theater I've ever been in. It had a slightly curved screen, really big, big, big screen for the number of seats in the theater. And incredible THX sound system back in the day in the 80s when Top Gun came out. And I would have been in high school, I think. And I went with my friend. I had to drive all the way downtown to see the movie, and it's a past downtown, so it was on the opposite side of Denver. I lived on the north side, and I believe the Century 21 was on the south side. So we saw the movie, and I remember watching it and like hearing the jets coming from behind me, and you know, and the sound design and the use of the discrete surround sound in that theater, and the way they mixed that picture was extraordinary. And it was the first time that during a movie, I really started to think about, man, somebody got to make this. Like somebody got to do all this. They got to put all this together, you know? And I just, that was kind of a recurring thought as I was having the experience of the movie. And I remember walking out into the parking lot. It was my friend Greg, and he said to me, he said, "So what'd you think?" And I said, "I think I know what I want to do for a living."
Nice.
And I still remember that. So I drove by myself. Well, actually I drove with a friend, but he just drove out with me and then went back home. But I drove not knowing a single person in California. I drove from Denver to California, where I was still 17,
Oh, wow.
to go to school and try to start studying cinema. You know, but as an undergrad, I got very distracted by my own existential crisis. So I ended up doing a lot more philosophy and theology and religious studies and trying to figure out my view of the world. I did a lot more of that for about 5 years before I then went to film school.
You're finding
Wow.
yourself.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, it was a really, really tough couple of years for me, those 4 or 5 years as an undergrad, but really seminal years for me. You know, I spent all the vast majority of that time reading way too many books and you know, and just forging my own point of view, really trying to come to terms with what I thought was true and what I felt like I needed to know in order to live my life, you know. And a lot of the things that I worked through then are things I still think and still believe. My philosophy and belief system's always open-minded and it's always evolving, but that was a lot of very focused work back in at that time.
That's interesting, considering your, you know, or at least what I think horror does. I think horror, it allows for a unique blend of like escapism, but also reflective commentary. And it's one of the reasons I like horror. Is that like, are those aspects one of the reasons you kind of gravitated towards it? And,
You
you
know,
know, with
it's a really incisive question, and you know, I had always loved horror films. I mean, I used to build haunted houses in the basement of my house as a kid and bring neighborhood kids through and stuff like that. And I always enjoyed, you know, getting together with friends and watching scary movies. We would watch Phantasm on late at night and like on HBO, you know, and the Dawn of the Dead movies and the hell, you know,
Yes.
and then and rent all the Halloween movies. And that was a very normal part of teenage life for me.
Exactly.
And then when I was really deep in all these, you know, mostly studying philosophy and reading, you know, lots of philosophical books and theoretical religious philosophy books, and I just, again, sort of coming to terms with what I believed about the world, about the nature of our existence, you know, how then shall we live was the question, you know. And during that time, I just wasn't watching a lot of movies, you know. I was reading all the time, and then at the end of that period of time, I decided I was going to become a filmmaker, and I got into film school at USC. So I started my graduate work there, and at that time, I had no intention of going into the horror genre in particular. And it was a very, you know, serendipitous event that really made me decide that was the genre I was going to gravitate toward. And I made a kind of horror-ish USC thesis film. And what happened was, at film school at that time, for some reason, people would sometimes hand they would sort of people would read things, and they would sort of hand off a book that everybody would read, you know, and they'd be like, "Oh, you got to read this, it's really great." And people did that with C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters.
Oh.
And I had read a lot of C.S. Lewis while I was in college as an undergrad, you know, because he's one of the more astute sort of orthodox Christian thinkers. But I read a lot of his
Right.
nonfiction stuff. I hadn't read any of his fiction. I tried to read the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, got bored by them. I'm not a big fan of that series. I think I eventually finished them because I was offered one of the movies, and so I read all of them. And boy, that I'm not a fan of his fiction for the most part. He wrote a space trilogy that some people are crazy about. Didn't really love that either. And I hadn't read the Screwtape Letters. And so somebody in this is a USC film school. These are not like religious people, you know, but they were like, it was a buddy of mine named Robert Stark. I still remember his good film school student name. And this guy gave me a copy of the book. He goes, "You got to read this." I was like, "I've always wanted to read this." And when I read it, it is my favorite C.S. Lewis book. And I think it's probably, you know, the single most influential creative work on me as an artist, because it was, you know, what it is it's a series of letters, fictional letters that are written from one demon to another, an uncle to his nephew, an uncle who's a demon to his nephew demon, basically saying, "Oh, you've been assigned a human being to really try to, you know, to ruin, because that's the job of demons, you know." And every letter is like, you know, 15 or 20 letters in the book, and every letter is an essay written during World War II by C.S. Lewis of, "This is how you really, really, can I swear on the show? Is
Of
swearing okay?"
course,
It's like, "This is
yes.
how you really fuck them up, you know. This is, you know, it's not the obvious way." And so as I was reading it, first of all, it's just kind of a brilliant concept, and it's brilliant literature. And but I was so amazed by how what I was reading was one of the most dense moralistic essay books I'd ever read. I mean, it was just every paragraph was just dense with moral and spiritual ideology, and yet it never felt that way at all, because it was all inverted. It was all everything that was moral in the book was actually immoral, and vice versa. And so there was something about like the flipping of the moral perspective. It was like, if you couch it, you know, in this, if you couch it in this inverted moral way, you can say very, very moral things, and people don't find it off-putting. You know, all these film students were loving this book. And so that got me thinking about it. And then I also read a book by a guy named Walker Percy, one of my favorite writers, a Southern Catholic writer, and he wrote a book called Lancelot, and it had a single sentence in it that hit me like a thunderbolt. And the sentence in it was, "Evil is the only true quest for for the modern day. What if God may be dead, but what if one should find the devil?" And I read that, and I was like, God, there's something to this idea of like what you can do with issues that concern me, issues of philosophy, issues of morality, you know, things that were really issues of even religion, I thought. And then I started watching, you know, different horror films, and the one that really sealed it for me was, which I hadn't seen, was while I was in film school, I saw Suspiria. And when I first saw Suspiria, it was an absolute revelation to me, like just total revelation. I'd never seen anything like it, because here was a movie, and I still to this day think that the first 20 minutes of Suspiria is the finest work in horror cinema history. I don't think anything can top that opening, the opening 20 minutes from the beginning of the film until the first kill. And I was like, here's a slasher movie. It's a slasher movie. It's a slasher movie. And I grew up with watching all the Friday the 13th movies and all the Halloween movies, and had seen you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street films. And this was a traditional slasher movie, but it was high art, and it was so beautifully made. And clearly this filmmaker was reaching for a pure cinema experience. And what had ha what hit me so hard was, there is room in the horror genre to push the art form forward in that genre. And I felt like I had seen enough horror cinema in my life that I knew that, you know, there were serious filmmakers out there, but the greatest horror film, serious horror filmmakers out there, but the greatest horror films, in American cinema had been made by great directors who weren't horror directors. They just did them as one-offs. You got, you know, you've got, you know, Kubrick's The Shining, and you know, The Omen, you know, made by the great Dick Donner, and, you know, these different horror films. So The Exorcist by William Friedkin, you know, so many of the best horror films that I'd ever seen were not directed by, you know, the typical John Carpenter, Wes Craven type directors. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I could get into the genre and try to do some more interesting things than what's being done, and sort of give the genre as much cinematic respect as I think that it deserves. That was my goal in going into it, you know. And that's certainly been, and Suspiria just was such a perfect example of that to me. And that's been my goal working in the genre ever since, is to, you know, to service the genre well. You know, people are paying to get scared, they're paying to have a good horror experience, but to also give them great cinema, you know. And I think that, you know, you can see the Argento influence is very clear in The Exorcism of Emily Rose, my first, you know, studio feature. And
I love that movie.
Yeah, and it's still my ambition in working in the genre, is to make things that are both, you know, really good cinema art and high horror entertainment.
That's so, like, there's a lot there that you said, and I wonder, I'm going off script a little bit. I wonder.
No, I wanted you to, actually, Kenny, because I know how much you love horror and everything that you literally just said. Like, seriously, everything that you just said, I'm like, Kenny probably has like 10 years of commentary.
Right.
Please.
So like, I want, like, you know, because you said, you know, things that you were talking about in terms of what the films are trying to do and whatnot. How do you feel about, because I kind of see that in old tropes where there's a hard stance on morality, but in a way that's kind of, in a way that doesn't really work in terms of people kind of agreeing with what's happening. Like, for instance, you'll have, actually, Cabin in the Woods does this well, where it kind of makes fun of those tropes, where you have each character has its own, you know, archetype, and then those characters are slain based on, you know, the things that they're doing. So if you have sex in a film, you die. If you drink in a film, you die. And it's like this weird push of like morality in some of these films, and which is interesting because the ones that I think that do it really well are like, you know, Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead, where, like, I'm a zombie fan, where they're looking at like racial issues, even haphazardly, or, you know, other issues or whatever, but it's done in a way that's like a little bit more, not on the nose as much as a person, like, you know, you had sex before you're married, so you die. Like, that's a little different. How do you feel about those type of tropes in horror?
I mean, I think it's hard to make a truly amoral horror film. I mean, I've seen them, they exist, and I think there's even immoral horror films.
Right.
But for the most part, once you get into what makes a horror film a horror film, you're inevitably dealing in moral issues. You know, you're immediately dealing with good and evil. You're immediately dealing with, in many cases, religion and the supernatural. Things that you know, touch on issues of faith and belief, and even if you're talking about, you know, like Dawn of the Dead, you know, not only does that touch heavily, and same with Night of the Living Dead, not only do those films deal heavily and beautifully with racial issues, especially linked to their time, but also consumerism and commercialism, you know, and it's part of what makes it was just part of what made the genre really attractive to me, you know, is that you can't really avoid a strong moral perspective when you're making a horror film, even if it's a straight slasher movie. It's not just a matter of, it's very true though, that you know, in like the typical early Friday the 13th movies, you know, you have sex, you die. It's one of the rules that they make fun of in Scream. But I think that it's also the fact that those movies function by creating empathetic points of view for the viewer, you know, in that you empathize with the victim. That's why you get scared. And so you're already, you know, vilifying and determining evil, that this kind of behavior, this random killing is a horrendous thing. And you know, and also the immorality of certain points of view and the immoral acceptance of certain ideologies come through as well. I think the sexism that's present in a lot of early horror films, including slasher films, is really interesting to look back on. You know, all of that is important. But I think that, you know, for me, the apex of it, and probably the film that gets the closest to me to doing what the Screwtape Letters did, which was a film that I think is a highly, highly direct moralistic essay in a lot of ways, dressed in an inverted point of view, so harrowing that you almost don't feel the moralizing qualities of the movie, is Seven. You know, and I think Seven is probably my favorite film, you know, of, you know, since the 80s. You know, probably if you took all the films that have been made since the 1990s forward, I think Seven is probably my favorite of all of them. And it's just a masterpiece on every level, but a part of it is how it speaks to me in the weird, confusing, inverted moral perspective of John Doe, in that, on, you know, what terrified me about that movie when I saw it, I mean, really made me scared, was as he was in the back of that car talking about his perspective and why he was doing what he was doing. I was like, my God, is he right? Is he right? they can't be right. If he can't be right, you know? And boy, did that movie get me thinking about the seven deadly, how you see a seven deadly sin on every corner, and don't even blink an eye. You don't even see it anymore. And I found myself really perplexed and sort of trapped in a cul-de-sac of thought about morality itself and those particular sins, you know, long after that movie had ended.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot.
No, oh, yeah. You know, it's the old philosophy student in me. I can talk about this stuff all day.
Oh, and that's, by the way, that is our philosophy student in training, my dog Hermione, so don't mind her.
Nice.
She gets excited when I get excited. But no, I just appreciate your answer. I appreciate how far in depth you went. And that's probably why, again, you can come back anytime, because we like to talk. But I'm going to move, just shift a little bit away from horror just for a second, because we see how much horror you've worked on, how many horror films you've worked on, and then you worked on Doctor Strange. And so I kind of want to know what led you to landing in the director's chair of a Marvel film, just because it's so interesting. When we did talk with David S. Sandberg, we asked him the same question, since he did a lot of horror as well, and he just said, well, you know, my horror films were really good, so I didn't even have to pitch. So was it the same for you?
Oh, no, I had to pitch. I had to work hard to get the job. I had to work really hard to get that job. But I was determined. I was really determined to get it. I had been approached by Marvel a few times since the early days, you know, after they had made the first Iron Man, and I think they had made the Incredible Hulk, or were making the Incredible Hulk. Mm-hmm. I was called in to meet with them about Thor, about the original Thor. This is way back in the day. And, you know, I think Kevin had been interested in my work from the beginning, and you know, he's got an incredible eye for talent, and historically has been very good at matching talent to material. Mm-hmm. And so I went and met with them, and I remember leaving there with a gigantic binder of Thor comics. And I grew up reading, you know, Doctor Strange and the Fantastic Four, and on the DC side, I read a lot of Aquaman.
Oh, nice.
You know, I was really kind of particular in that I would pick specific comic characters, and then I would just read everything that belonged to those characters. And I just never read any Thor. And so I went home and did a big binge read, and I was just like, I don't know how to do this. I don't have any idea, you know? And it was just very clearly not a good match for me. You know, how do you, and I actually, you know, I know that the original Thor isn't, you know, ranked high on on people's you know, lists for when they rank all the MCU movies. But I really think that Kenneth Branagh, you know, was an inspired choice for that, because boy, that movie just should have been ridiculous, you know. And they brought in a guy who had the operatic theatricality and respect for that kind of historical storytelling, you know, to tell something that you took really seriously. And I think it worked very well. So it, I don't know if I ever if I met with them any other point along the way, but I got a call from my agent and saying Marvel's gonna make Doctor Strange one of their next movies. They called about you. Are you interested? And I was like, oh my God, you know, I
Nice.
remember tell I remember telling her I'm the right guy to make Doctor Strange. You know, like I just had an immediate reaction to that of like, I understand that character. I understand what was great about the comics. You know, and in both, I think it was for me, it was the visual ambition, the sort of occultic way that it played with the dark side, and just the lonely austerity of Doctor Strange himself, and this guy who was always in a kind of moral crisis and always struggling with himself. You know, these were the things that I loved about that character, and that had stayed with me. So yeah, I went after that job hard, man.
That's awesome. So are you, I mean, I know you, you know, you're saying that you read, you know, a ton of comics and everything. Was the being a comic book fan, were you always outside of Thor and I guess, you know, Doctor Strange, were you always interested in, you know, pursuing comic books at all? Outside of like, you know, the films you were doing originally, like, were you always like, you know, I'm gonna do a comic book movie one day, you know, whether it's Batman or whatever, like, I wanna do something along this, you know, fantasy realm of superheroes. Was this something that you always wanted to do?
Well,
Or this was
no,
like,
you know, I mean, I was already, you know, starting my career was already moving when the when Marvel was really starting up, and so my career was growing alongside the spreading of the comic book, you know, popularity. And I'd seen the Tim Burton Batman movies and loved them, but never thought that was something I would do. Yeah, I just I really enjoyed them, and I appreciated what they were, and was pretty mind blown, like everybody else, at the batting average that I was seeing from Marvel. But I honestly, I never thought that would be something I would do. I never thought it would be something for me, and so it wasn't any particular desire to make a comic book movie or to work on a movie of that scale. It was specifically Doctor Strange. It was specifically that comic. And that character that I you know, gravitated toward. I don't, you know, I have I'm still limited in the number of comics that I've read and the characters that I know, but that was the one that I knew I was really right for. And I so far, if I look at the entire you know at the entire history of Marvel and DC Comics, I don't think there's another one that I would step up and fight to do. I don't think there's another one I would feel right for. You know, it's also the, you know, the grounded fantastical quality of Doctor Strange. You know, and the spirituality of Doctor Strange. You know, these are all things that spoke to me as a kid, but just stayed with me. And then in revisiting them, I was like, man, this is my thing. You know, it just felt like such a good fit.
It
You sound
was
like
a
you.
good fit. I'm commenting. It was a
Yeah.
good fit. I love Doctor Strange. Kenny knows how much I love that movie. I thought it was brilliant. I thought everything about that movie was brilliant. I don't care what anybody says. No, I love that
You know,
movie.
and the thing I think the thing I'm the most proud of is that, you know, I made a $200 million comic book movie about spirituality. That's ultimately what that movie is. You know, it's about you know, one man overcoming himself through spiritual growth and enlightenment. And very proud of that, you know, aspect of it. And the fact that I think it's, you know, I'm tooting my own horn here, but I still think it's
Shoot.
as good as any comic book movie when it comes to visual effects and introducing new visual language to the genre.
It had a Matrix effect. It definitely did.
I want to ask how you felt about Doctor Strange in What If? I because of, you know, him, the devolving into the person that he becomes in What If you did see it. I just want to know how you felt about that.
I never saw the finished version. When I was working on Doctor Strange, they were, you know, those kind of animations take a long time to complete. And I think that we were still in prep. I don't even think we were in post when I saw the first rough animation of it, you know, that was just like just drawings, no color, no nothing. And it was just a drawing and a rough soundtrack for the story. And I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was really great. But I did not watch any of the What If shows. I haven't seen them. I'd like to, you know, they're just things I haven't gotten around to. But I did see the whole story, so I knew what it was, and that's the reason why they let me see it. I was just like, oh, if you're doing something else with Doctor Strange, it's going to be coming out. I need to see it. No, I was in post for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, what am I thinking? No, I wasn't. I was in prep for Doctor Strange 2. That's when I saw it.
Oh yeah. Wow. Okay. Guys, okay. They had these stories way back then. Good.
No,
grief.
No. I lost my mind there for a second. I got okay. lost in time.
It happens.
Yeah.
I feel like you would be a fan of the Sandman comic.
My God! I almost directed that pilot. I wanted to direct that pilot.
Oh wow.
I really love the Sandman comics. You know. I was offered a job by Warner Brothers, and I told Neil Gaiman this. I was offered a job by Warner Brothers. I don't remember what year it was, but at some point during my career, to do one of the screenplay adaptations of Sandman, because they had been trying to develop it for years, and I declined. And they were like, "Really? We thought you'd really be." I said, "Oh, I love Sandman. That's one of my favorite comic series ever made." I mean, if I had to say of everything I've ever actually read, probably Watchmen and Sandman are the best comics I've ever read. And I said, I'm just not going to be the guy who fucked up Sandman, you know, because as a movie, I just didn't see a way to do it. I just didn't think there was a way to make Sandman into a feature film and still have it be Sandman, you know.
Right.
And so when I heard that they were doing it as a TV series, I was like, well, that's the way you do Sandman. It's the only way you can do justice to that material, and you know, and you don't have to be slavish to it, but it's a very unique, very sprawling, you know, very hodgepodge tapestry, that comic, and I think that's a lot of its greatness is in that. So I came very close to doing it, and then there were issues with scheduling. There was other things that came up, and I ended up not doing it. And fortunately, I'm glad I didn't, because I had to go make Black Phone.
Speaking of the Black Phone, I know it's based on the Joe Hill's short story. Beyond it being like a great read, what inspired you to kind of make it into a feature film? Did you approach Hill, or did he approach you, or how did that come about?
Well, I had read the comic. I'd read the short story when it was first published, which was like 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was having lunch with the great German director Wim Wenders, who's one of my closest friends and godfather to my children. That's a whole nother story.
Oh.
But we had lunch at this, it was breakfast. We had breakfast at this little French bistro place that we would go to on Sunday mornings sometimes in Los Feliz. And it was a small group of us, and everybody was just hanging out, chatting afterwards. And I just got up and left the table and wandered up the street to the Skylight Bookstore, which is a bookstore I really love. And I went to their horror section, and they had on display the new horror fiction. And there was this book, 20th Century Ghosts. So I was like, oh, what's this? You know, Joe Hill, never heard of him. I had no idea he was Stephen King's son. No one did at that time. He was very, very committed to publishing his first works without anyone knowing who his dad was. So I picked
I
it
did
up.
Not know that.
Yeah, he actually got a couple of, you know, he had I think the first few things he wrote never got published. They got declined, you know, but he was like, if I'm going to succeed, I'm going to succeed on my own merit. And 20th Century right. Ghost was the first thing that he published. And so I just was standing in the bookstore, and I opened to the first story. And the first story, it's an anthology of short stories. And the first of the, you know, there's maybe a dozen short stories in it. And the first short story was called Best New Horror. And I thought, oh my God, the balls on this guy, you know, publishes his first book of horror short stories. And the first book is called Best New Horror. I was like, this better be good, you know? And so I stood there in the Skylight bookstore and I read that story. And it was, to this day, one of the best and scariest stories I've ever read. I've since optioned it and I'm working with another writer on it, but it just as an aside. But I was blown away. I thought it was incredible. So I bought the book and went home and read all the short stories. There's not a bad story in that book, by the way. They're all good. And there's one called Pop Art. It's not a horror story. That's just one of the best short stories I've ever read. But The Black Phone stood out to me as a movie. You know, I just immediately felt like, oh, this is a movie. And what it was about it was I read the story and I thought, I kept thinking about it. Like, it feels like a movie. Why do I keep thinking about the story as a movie? And then I realized, I think probably year, because I didn't option or do anything about it for years. But I think I eventually realized, you know why that's such a good idea is because what that short story did is something that really no one's ever done, at least not effectively. And it combined a serial killer with a ghost story,
right.
A serial killer story and a ghost story in one basement, basically the whole, and it's not a long story. It's only, you know, as I remember, it's like 20 or 25 pages or something like that. And so, I hold on one second. Oh, and so I gave it when I started working with Cargill. Very early on, you know, Cargill and I had a different writing partner until Sinister. And the first thing I wrote with Cargill was Sinister. And I think shortly after we made Sinister, I gave him that book. And he ended up becoming a novelist and became friends with Joe Hill apart from me. In fact, Joe and Cargill and Neil Gaiman and one other writer are part of like a little Inklings group that meet occasionally to talk about novel writing. And nice. But I gave him the book and he read it and he was like, it's a movie, but it's the second act of a movie is what Cargill's read on it was. So we were always trying to think of, you know, what is there a way to do this as a film? You know, what, because it needed some real obvious expansion. And what happened then was I stepped off of Multiverse of Madness and I had, oh, actually, sorry, let me back up. It was before that. While I was on Multiverse of Madness, the writer that we hired to write the first draft was taking a very long time to get that draft done. And I was just kind of twiddling my thumbs waiting for scripts. And so I said to Cargill, I said, I've got time on my hands. Why don't we just write something just to write it? And he's like, great, let's do it. And I had been in therapy for 3 years at that point, dealing mostly with my childhood trauma. You know, grew up in a really violent neighborhood and there was a lot of violence, just a lot of violence in my childhood. And and so I was thinking, you know, what if I remember saying to Cargo, you know, I'm thinking about trying to do like an American 400 Blows, you know, like what Francis Truffaut did in sort of portraying his childhood in France. And I thought about that for a while and I was like, no, my childhood doesn't have any real narrative to it that's interesting. I just didn't feel like that was a good idea. And then it was a real eureka moment when I thought, well, wait a minute, what if I took the actual neighborhood that I grew up in North Denver, and the kind of violence that I was around in my home and the kind of bullying I was around, and just, you know, took what it felt like to me growing up in being 12 in North Denver in 1978. What if I took all that and some of the kids that I knew and combined it with The Black Phone? And when I called Cargill, and Cargill, you know, is my best friend, knows everything about me. And so when I told him, he already knew a lot of the stories of my childhood. And he was just like, that's it. Let's do it. Let's, you know, and then we wrote it in 5 weeks. It was really, really fast, easy adaptation for us. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That 5 weeks, that is a great movie.
Yeah. It was a very, I think probably the fastest script that we've ever written, actually. And then, you know, the plan was to give it to another director. because I was going to be gone making a Multiverse of Madness for 2 years. And then now to get jumped to the part that I started earlier, then when I stepped off of Multiverse of Madness, here was the script. It was done. It was, finished and very, very personal to me. And as soon as that decision had been made, I decided I'm going to go make Black Phone.
Wow.
Yeah. Well,
considering your personal connection to the film, how do you separate or protect yourself from the content? Because there's obviously bound to be triggering aspects that may be like close to home. Obviously, you said you grew up in a like violent neighborhood, but even that was used as inspiration.
Well, it was kind of the opposite. I had spent 3 years digging into all that stuff. I just spent the last 3 years, and there's stuff from my childhood that was too dark. There's one scene that I actually put in the draft. And Carga was like, that can't be in here.
Are you okay?
that one was a bridge too far. I was like, that was the inspiration that I was feeling which is I had done all this work for years to really come to terms with and reckon with those specific traumas of my childhood and what it was like, for me being a child where the primary emotion that I felt as a kid was fear, I remember my therapist at one point, my therapist at one point, with no irony, I thought it was really hysterical. And I remember he looked at me after I told him one particular story. He said, "You do realize that you're childhood was a ripe breeding ground for a serial killer, don't you?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I do." And that was a part of growing up, and part of why it fit with the Black Phone too, because I had, like one of the things that happened to me that's not in the movie, but this was a true story. I was 9 years old when the kid next door knocked on my door at night, and I opened the door, and he was crying his eyes out. And he said, "Somebody murdered my mom," and his mother had been abducted and raped and wrapped in phone cord and thrown in the local lake, and Ted Bundy had just come through Colorado and killed a bunch of women. And he escaped in Colorado. So there was just like the fear and the Manson murders had happened not that long before that. So there was all this sort of the stranger danger of the late 70s. Was a very real thing, like a very real thing for me, living with with the thought of, oh, there's people out there who will just snatch you up from your bed or snatch you up off the street and kill you, so that's all made its way into the fabric of the movie also.
That was the whole dropping of the eggs and stuff was just like, okay, this is too much. I was really concerned because I was like, oh my God, I always think about the kids. I really do, because too many TV shows really remind me of what kids really do get up to, and I saw he dropped the groceries and I'm like, oh God, it's too easy these kids.
It's a very, very, very bizarre thing too. This is true. My brother, who still lives in Denver, said that he knew that because the movie was so popular, everybody was seeing it. And he said that he spoke to 3 different people unrelated to each other that he knew who, upon seeing the Black Phone, remembered something that they had forgotten about, which was their own attempted abduction.
Oh, God.
Like 3 different people. And I was like, if one happened to one person, it would be strange to me. But my brother was like, yeah, these 3 different people told me that they had sort of blocked out or forgotten that somebody had tried to abduct them and they got away. And they told, and they happened to know my brother and told him that came back to them when they saw the Black Phone. And I heard that story, and normally I would think, well, that's gotta be bullshit, but my brother, he's 6 years older than me, and I've never once known him to lie about anything, So I know that that was true.
Oh, wow.
That's scary. That's true. Even 80s. I remember like my parents telling me like, don't speak to strangers, and going through this whole routine of like how to stay away from strangers and whatnot, and not to trust basically anyone. So it very, very much hit home for me when I was watching it in the theater.
Yeah. And you think
and the domestic violence was very much of that time. I mean,
right.
You know, I saw, you know, I got beat like that. My siblings got beat like that. But it wasn't just me. You know, that was pretty common. You know,
I'm raising my hand. You can't see it, but I'm raising.
Yeah. And there were kids on my block that had it much worse. There was one kid who lived on the corner. I lived on a house. I was the youngest on a street block. Like, you know, I lived in an area in North Denver where they had actual blocks, you know, where you could walk all the way around the block. There was like a grid.
Yeah.
And on my block, there was a kid on the far corner whose dad was really violent. And I remember him coming up, you know, to where we were playing Nerf football or something, and he had just these huge bleeding welts on the back of his leg because his dad had whipped him with an extension cord, you know. And it was like, I remember we were just like, oh dude, that sucks. And then, you know, let's play football. And it just was how it was.
It bees like that.
It does. Yeah. It does. It sounds very familiar. Not even going to hold you.
Yeah, nope. I mean, I was like, it was the orange cord because, you know, anyway, I don't want to go there. we know that this isn't your first time working with kids. Obviously there's some other films like Sinister, and it has obviously disturbing content with younger actors. So how much work goes into prepping kids for these roles, and are there any like lingering aspects once the film is over with them?
I mean, in terms of kids working in a horror film, they love it. You know, Halloween is mostly a holiday for children.
Oh,
you know, right. and they it's, so for them it's just like Halloween every day for weeks, and you know, they love getting the blood put on them and the scars if they're the ghost kids and all that. It's like Halloween, you know. So there's never any, first of all, horror films are a really joyous place to be, believe it or not. I mean, my experience is that people really have fun making them, and kids really get it. In fact, one of the funniest things I remember was, you know, in Sinister, the kids only have one shot, I think, in the movie when they're together, and otherwise all of their scenes are isolated. They're never really in the same scenes together. And so they had, on the night that we shot that one shot, which was outside, Cargill, my writing partner, told me the story that he was down in the basement of this house, the house where we shot Sinister, and we had made like a little office down there, and the kids were all down there, and they met each other for the first time. And one of them said, he overheard, and one of them said, the other one said, they were all in a group and said, so how did you kill your parents? And one of them said, lawnmower. And then one girl goes, oh, I just got to drown mine. It's like, so, you know, it's a little different when you're talking about, you know, a scene like Madeline McGraw's, you know, scene when she gets whipped
and has to cry and all that.
Yeah, you know, and I first of all, any kid that I put into a horror film, I think this would be true in of any film that I would ever direct, you know, the casting process for me involves casting the parents, you know. And I've had kids that I was leaning toward casting until I met their parents, and just felt like this kid does not have a secure enough home system to be subjected to, you know, the world of Hollywood, especially if the film is a big success and they get lots of attention. That's, you know, so I have to, every kid I've ever cast, I feel like they've got a good protective home environment, and good parents. And I keep the parents, I like the parents with me in Video Village when I shoot with them, all of that kind of stuff. But you know, that scene, I just talk to them mostly like adults. You know, I find that kids, especially if they're good actors, are very emotionally intelligent, and they don't have trouble understanding you when you talk about emotional intentions and, you know, and the purpose of a scene and understanding in any given moment why they're responding or why they should be feeling certain things, you know. And the youngest actress I ever worked with was, you know, I was the first person to cast Lulu Wilson, who went on to become the girl in Ouija 2, and then in Mike Flanagan's great Haunting of Hill House. She's had a huge career. She was 6 when I cast her, and I just remember kneeling down with her and saying to her, I've spoken to her, you know, not just in the last couple of years, and we talked about this. She really remembers this, and I said, I'm going to tell you the only thing you ever really need to know about acting. And I said, if I tell this to you and you really understand it, you're going to be a great actress. And she said, okay. And I said, okay, here it comes. Are you ready? And she's like, I'm ready. And I said, acting is not pretending. And I remember her just like looking at me and kind of slowly nodding. I said, it's not pretending. You have to really feel it. You have to feel what you're doing. It's not pretending. It's being there really in that moment as that person. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I understand. And she was, you know, gifted actress. So, you know, with someone like Madeline in a scene like that, I just prepared her was the main thing. Yeah. I just talked to her a couple of times on days before that, the day of that shoot. I didn't want to scare her and get her psyched out about it. But I think two times I went to her and sort of started to broach the subject about that scene and said, I really need you to cry. I'm really going to need you to get, you know, Gwen's a very strong character, but she gets broken at least momentarily by the scene, you know, and it's going to be really emotional. And, you know, and she's working with Jeremy Davies, who's very much a method actor and really just loses himself in the moment. So in my mind, I'm like, I don't know what he's going to do, you know?
scary.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I remember the second time I talked to her about it the day before we shot, I think she just said, she came up to me on her own afterwards. And she said, I have one question for you about the whipping scene tomorrow. And I said, yeah. And she said, would it be okay if I took like 2 minutes by myself right before we shoot to just really get ready? I said, of course, Madeline, that's what actors do. I said, don't ever feel bad about asking me or any director for that, you know? And so that's what we did. We just sort of, before we shot, everybody got quiet. She was just in her own space. And when she was ready, we rolled, you know? And I think, you know, that scene, the two favorite scenes that I've shot as a director are both highly emotional, actor driven scenes. And it's the domestic quarrel in Sinister in the bedroom between the long, it's like a 5 minute argument between Ethan Hawke and Juliet Rylance. And I just love that scene so much. And I really did the same thing with them. I told them days in advance, you guys got to really deliver on the scene. It's very important. And and I love it because I can't think of another horror film that has a scene anything like that in it. But I think my other favorite one is that kitchen scene because I love to watch actors do what they do when they're really going all the way and they surprise you. And Jeremy, just to give you know the most powerful moment of that scene is toward the end of it, you know, I was strategic about it because I thought you have to be careful because you can go too far with a scene like that. Yeah. I thought, you know, what the audience doesn't want to see is they don't want to see that belt actually hit that girl. Nobody wants to see that.
Right.
You know, I don't want to see that. No one wants to see that. So I picked the house that I picked because it had that long counter that stretched out into the middle of the room. And I knew that I could place Finney in a position where he's watching and we're watching with him the whipping go down, but she would be behind the counter. And then when he really goes crazy, he could throw her on the floor and he could just really beat on her, but we wouldn't see her at all. Mm-hmm. And we would just hear it. And I thought that would be more effective. And so, you know, I knew that stuff was going to be really disturbing. And I sort of choreographed it in a way that I thought would push the boundaries, but not, you know, break them. And then the best part comes when she gets back up and she's really crying. She's really weeping at that moment. And it was Jeremy's idea to say to her, to make her say it three times. Cause in the script it just said, you know, your dreams are just fucking dreams. Let me hear you say it. In the script, she just says, my dreams are just dreams. And then he says, now get out of here. That's how it is in the script. And Jeremy came to me, I think on the day of, and said, I want to make her say this three times. And in my mind, I was like, oh, fine. You know, if it doesn't work, we'll cut two of them out. So I said, sure, go ahead. And I think I told Madeline that he was going to do that, but we never rehearsed it. We never rehearsed the lines that way or anything. And then when we shot in that moment, it's my favorite acting moment by any actor in any film I've ever done. When he says to her, you know, let me hear you say it. And she's sobbing. She says, my dreams are just dreams. Say it again. and tears are pouring down her face. She's like, my dreams are just dreams. And then he goes, say it again. And something clicks in Madeline playing Gwen, because she knew Gwen so well. And something clicks, and all of a sudden she turns almost feral and angry and spits back at him with this fierce look. And she's like, my dreams are just dreams. And I think it really surprised Jeremy, the actor, because he kind of recoils, like he wasn't expecting that, you know? I wasn't expecting that. And it sort of deflates the whole scene. And then he lowers the belt and he's like, now get out of here. And it's just beautiful, you know?
It was brilliant.
And that is brilliant. And kids can do that if they're that good, you know, if they have the kind of raw talent that somebody like Madeline McGraw has, but you got to give them, you know, the arena of safety and protection and trust them, you know, to do amazing things, because that's what good actors do. They amaze you.
I couldn't agree more.
That scene was, all of that was awesome. And what you were saying about the part where she's on the floor and you know, you can't see what's happening, is very Alfred Hitchcock, you know, Psycho, when you don't actually see, you know, the stabbing, you just kind of hear. And so your mind puts everything together and makes it worse in a sense.
It makes it more effective, but it also gives you, you know, it gives you, it forces you to sort of stay with it, you know, in ways that you can't. I think once you start seeing it, there's a part of your brain that just kind of checks out. You're like, okay, well, and there's a great story that I remember reading about Reservoir Dogs, and how, if I remember the story correctly, Tarantino shot a close-up of the police officer's ear being cut off by Michael Madsen. And I believe that they tested it with and without that shot. And there was one where he cut it off and it was a close-up. And the audience, you know, watched him cut the ear off and they didn't really react. And the other take was when he starts to cut on his ear and the camera pans up to the ceiling and you hear him screaming. And then when it pans back down or tilts back down, you know, the ear has been removed. And when they test screened that as the camera, you know, tilts away and you just hear him screaming, several people walked out. because it was too much. It was so much more effective. So yeah, it's always more effective if you can put things in the audience's mind over putting it, you know, in front of their eyes.
Yep. That's the way the brain works. And you know, it's true.
Nothing is scarier than our imaginations.
You got that right. Oh my goodness. Okay. So this is our fun question. We're going to get into the fun round. So
let's do it.
What would you do if you weren't a director or a screenwriter? Do you have any hobbies that you could imagine doing as a different career?
Yeah, I would be a full-time college film history professor. I teach film history when I can. I teach a course on Kurosawa, where I have watch all 30 of his films. And,
nice.
And we do deep studies in all of his work. And I teach a course on the history of European cinema, which is probably my first love. I love classic European cinema.
Cinema Paradiso.
That is awesome.
Yeah, yeah, but I especially you know, going back to the French New Wave and Italian New Realism and some of those great European film history movements that you know spawned some of the greatest cinema in the world. I love that stuff.
All right, nice. So this next one will be our last question.
Have my lightning round.
Because we're coming up on an hour, so I don't want to hold you.
Won't be long.
All right, go ahead.
Okay.
Do I need to give faster answers?
This is the lightning round, so it's fast.
Okay, I'm gonna answer quick.
It is only like five questions because I, you know, anyway, I cut some out. All right, lightning round. Okay, ready. Yeah. Favorite horror film. Period.
Suspiria.
Wonderful. All right, favorite Marvel movie.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Nice.
Okay, favorite villain of all time?
John Doe in Seven.
That's a nice one. A favorite Targaryen?
I always call her Khaleesi. What's her, what's her card? Yeah, I always blank her Targaryen name, but yes, her. The obvious answer.
A favorite fictional universe.
Ooh, that's a great one. Favorite fictional universe. Do you mean imaginative, like genre, like fantastical, or just fictional of any kind?
Any fictional universe of any kind. It could be like what's like the Dune universe, or it could be
That would my answer would be the white Anglo-Protestant universe of John Updike's Rabbit Quartet.
Rabbit Quartet. Okay, there are four
novels that really capture the white American male over four decades. There's four books, four novels. He wrote each of them 10 years apart, kind of autobiographical, I think. And both the third and the fourth one won the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, nice.
Okay, I need to get in on that one then. And I have what adaptation would you die to create?
Oh, snap. Ooh,
Paradise Lost.
Oh, wow. Ooh. That's a good one. That was my last one, but then I also just threw in what's your favorite anime if you watch it? Because we didn't go there.
Oh, Cowboy Bebop.
Yes!
Oh, okay, you're coming back. You're
awesome! Coming back. That was it. Great.
That's my lightning round.
That was great. That is awesome.
Awesome.
You know, I don't even care about my last question. That rocks. All right. So yeah, again, thanks for hanging out with us. We appreciate your time. I know you guys are busy doing all sorts of creative things. So, you know, whenever someone says yes to come on the show, we really, really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun, man.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you. So everybody who's checking out the podcast, if you're listening on whatever you're listening on, whether it's iTunes or Google Podcasts or whatever the case, feel free to subscribe and, you know, add us to your RSS feed. If you're listening on YouTube, please subscribe and hit that notification bell so you're up on all the new content that's coming. We have a lot of, special guests that are going to be coming on. We have a lot of topics that we cover. So definitely, definitely hit those buttons so you know what's going on. All right.
All the buttons. Thanks for joining with us another time, guys. We always appreciate you. Just remember everything that I always say every week. I can't remember what I always say every week, but be kind, wash your hands, wash your faces, wash your butts, wear your masks, # don't be a dick. That's it. See you next time, guys. Bye-bye.